Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of the 11th century scholar and bishop St. Peter Damian during his catechesis at his Wednesday General Audience. Little White Flower. The relics of St. Thérèse of Lisieux arrive in Britain next week for the first time ever, and we explore the enduring popularity of this 19th century saint, whose relics have now visited more than 40 countries and even gone up in space. Suicide Lifeline. As the UN marks the World Day for the Prevention of Suicide, we find out how the Church is trying to reach out to those who may be tempted to take their own life. And Missio. We discover why the Pontifical Mission Societies have decided upon a name change. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of St. Peter Damian, the 11th century scholar and bishop. Chris Altieri tells us more.
St. Peter Damian was a nobleman who was born in Ravenna at the beginning of the 11th century and became an accomplished writer and Latinist. Pope Benedict remembered him as a monk and a lover of solitude, who was also one of the eminent churchmen of his age, who was personally involved in the implementation of the century's papal church reforms. St. Peter Damian was an accomplished teacher and man of letters as well.
His fine sensitivity made him excel in poetry and enabled him to see the world as a parable, full of symbolic references to the supernatural, leading him to embrace as a mature man a monastic vocation at Fonte Avellana, founded not long before.
The Holy Father said St. Peter Damian was fascinated by the salvific mystery of the cross of Christ and promoted as the fullness of Christian living a form of monasticism noted for its austerity.
Nourished by a mystical understanding of Scripture, St. Peter Damian enjoyed precise theological insights, especially into the mysteries of the Holy Trinity, our union with Christ, and the Church as a communion, from which he derived practical advice for living in charity with others.
St. Peter Damian was eventually called to serve the Pope directly.
In 1057, he accepted the office of Cardinal Bishop of Ostia and assisted the Pope with courage and dedication in the reform of the Church of his time. After 10 years, he was granted his wish to return to his monastery and continue to serve the Church with prayer and action until his holidays in 1072.
Pope Benedict prayed that the example and intercession of St. Peter Damian might inspire and renew us all in our love of Christ and his Church. I'm Chris Altieri.
She's one of the world's best-loved saints, and her relics have already visited more than 40 countries, and a piece of her clothing has even been taken up in space by an astronaut. And now, for the first time ever, the relics are coming to England and Wales next week for a month-long tour. In case you're wondering, I'm talking about Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, the French Carmelite nun who died in 1897 at the age of 24, and whose fame since her short life has spread across the world, prompting some secular commentators to describe her as a global Catholic superstar. But why does this 19th century saint, who lived an uneventful life within the confines of a Carmelite convent in a small French town, have such an enduring global appeal? An expert on the life of St. Thérèse, Canon John Udris, is Dean of Northampton Cathedral. He's also the author of two books about the saint. The first is called The Holy Daring, and the second is called The Gift of Thérèse of Lisieux. He told me more about this much-loved and venerated saint and spoke of his hopes ahead of the forthcoming tour of her relics in Britain.
I'm really excited at the prospect, anticipating eagerly how people are going to respond to that tour. I think it's at this stage hard to judge how people are going to respond. My hope is that if the natural reserved English temperament means that local people, perhaps a little bit unsure at the beginning, that the new communities, that new cultures that comprise our communities here in England and Wales will lead the way. I'm sure those from Africa and Asia, as well as our own travelling community and so on, will find the prospect of the tour immediately attractive and something I hope that we'll learn from.
Okay, so let's go in and look a little bit closer at the figure of this saint. Her relics have been to, I gather, about 40 different countries. I mean, she's got an incredible global appeal, and yet she's somebody who lived in a sort of rural backwater of northern France and barely travelled for the whole of her life. And that was, of course, in the 19th century.
I think one of the amazing things about Thérèse's relics going on tour around the world has been that she is actually fulfilling a dream of hers. She once expressed it so beautifully. She said, "My dream is to travel the earth preaching the gospel." And of course, obviously, she never got the chance to do that while she was alive and a Carmelite nun. But ever since her death, she's been fulfilling that wish. And I think part of that dream is being fulfilled here in England and Wales.
So how did you first become particularly fascinated by the life and teachings of Saint Thérèse? Tell us something about that.
In the early 90s, I was doing some studies in Rome, and it came to choosing a subject for my thesis. And I was very attracted at the time. The Catechism had just been published, and I was very attracted by something in the final section of the Catechism on prayer, the introduction to the Lord's Prayer, "Let us pray with confidence to the Father." And it's that word that I wanted to explore, and so the thesis was around that concept of confidence. But as I wrote the thesis, I began to sense that for people, generally, we need a person rather than a notion to help us. And so I asked myself, well, who do I know who exemplifies that confidence? And of course, the person that came to mind immediately was Thérèse. And obviously, I had to prove that, to look at her writings and explore that whole concept of confidence. But essentially, my thesis became Thérèse as the icon of that confidence by which we pray the Our Father. So that's how my interest in her began.
And if you had to pick one out, what is your favourite prayer or saying of hers? In fact, if it's quite brief, could you perhaps share it with us?
Sure. I think my favourite prayer of Thérèse, the one that goes to the very heart of what she was about, was in fact the shortest one, the one that she wrote on a little piece of paper and kept in a little pouch above her heart. And it's just simply, "Jesus, make me just like you." So that whole concept of imitation, Jesus was the one that she wanted to be like, to imitate, and that was the supreme ambition of her life and one of the fundamental themes of her spirituality.
So tell us, what was she like as a person? I mean, she had a very difficult life, she had a lot of bereavement, a lot of physical suffering.
I think what attracts me about Thérèse is her straightforward simplicity. When you read her writing, there's something refreshingly honest about it. And I think, I'm sure this is probably part of her universal appeal, is she doesn't try to be somebody she's not. Although she's striving for holiness, she recognizes and acknowledges her weaknesses and her failings. And I think that's something that's such a relief, really, is that here we've got a saint who was weak and who actually sees in her weaknesses her way to God. And I think in that we can all find something encouraging and I think hopeful for our own journey in holiness.
Now, of course, her fame rests entirely, it might be said, given her uneventful life, upon the publication of her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, shortly after her death. How did you feel after first reading this book? What are its great strengths?
I first read The Story of a Soul in my teens, would you believe, the very first place I went to abroad. I was about 11. I went on a pilgrimage with my mum to Lisieux, and I know we picked up a copy of The Story of a Soul there. I didn't read it immediately, but in my teens I read it. It was some Ronald Knox's translation, and it's rather syrupy, it's rather flowery language, and I have to say I wasn't in the first instance terribly enamoured of it or struck by it. So it was a few years before I read it again, and the next time I read it, it was John Clark's translation, more recent translation, and a very much more accurate translation of the story. And it was when I read that I was struck by her simplicity, and that's the reason I think I must have since then have read it about 6 or 7 times over again, and always finding something new in it.
Now, you talked about this rather syrupy impression you got the first time you read her autobiography, and St. Therese has also sometimes been described as having rather a sort of sugary image. Yet, I mean, she had, shall we say, her dark moments, didn't she? She had doubts over her faith, her physical suffering. So why was she called the little flower, and how accurate is that?
Well, she called herself, in fact, the story, where we get the title, The Little Flower, is the sort of subtitled of The Story of a Soul is the springtime story of a little white flower. So it's her own description in a way of herself. And I think it can be deceptively syrupy or flowery, literally, language. And of course, she was no shrinking violet. She, you say, she had a fair share of suffering in her life, and indeed towards the end of her life, when at the onset of tuberculosis, the last 18 months or so were a very dark time indeed for her, a time when she felt no consolation from her faith, a time when, you know, she said she now knew what it felt for some people not to be able to believe in God. And yet, at the same time, in those last months, she was able to write some of her most beautiful and passionate writings and prayers and poems, which show us that actually through that crucible of suffering, she was coming to an even deeper and more intimate relationship with the Lord.
You've written 2 books about St. Therese. Tell us briefly what message you're trying to get across in each of them.
In that first book, Holy Daring, this was the book that I then wrote after my thesis in Rome, and this explores the confidence of Therese, the fearless trust of Therese. This is the dimensions of her spirituality, that one of the crucial dimensions, I would say, the sort of 2 wings of her way to God are trust and love. They were the words she kept repeating, and that first book explores that whole concept of trust or confidence. The second book is The Gift of Therese of Lisieux, and that's quite a different book. It's a book of, you can sort of pick up and perhaps use for prayer. It's illustrated, it's got quotations from her writings, and it explore some of her major themes of her spirituality: littleness, vocation, prayer, Jesus, weakness, gratitude, things like that. So different aspects of her teaching. And it's called The Gift of Therese because I think it explores, it comes to open up essentially that her whole understanding of love is to give oneself. In one of her beautiful poems, she says, loving is giving everything. It is giving oneself. And I think she has taught us actually that a life well lived is a life well given.
Okay, coming back to the tour of her relics, what do you believe is the main significance and will be the main lasting impact of it?
I hope people will appreciate that the focus of the visit of the relics will be not Therese, but Jesus. After all, he was the focus, the supreme goal and ambition of all that she was about. And so I see the forthcoming tour as an opportunity for Therese to preach the gospel to us, to preach, to raise up us. And I hope that as people approach the relics, as they hopefully will reach out and touch the relics, it will be a way of people reaching out and touching someone who helps us to be in touch with Jesus, essentially. That is my hope and expectation of the forthcoming tour.
I was speaking to Canon John Udris, expert on the life of Saint Thérèse of Lisieux. Suicide is a difficult and sensitive subject, and is an issue that is still often surrounded by a strong stigma. But despite the human being's natural instinct for self-preservation, everyday despairing men and women who are finding their life simply too painful and intolerable take the drastic step of killing themselves. In Britain and Ireland, figures show that around 6,000 people commit suicide each year, and the vast majority are young men. As the international community marks World Suicide Prevention Day this week, I've been trying to discover more about what reasons compel a person to take his or her own life, and what the church is doing to try to reach out to those who may be struggling with suicidal thoughts. This year, the church in Britain and Ireland chose suicide as a theme for its annual Day for Life, and says it hopes this focus will help raise awareness of the vital role played by families and a supportive parish community in sustaining those who may be struggling to cope. Bishop John Fleming of Killala is the delegate for the Day for Life celebration on behalf of the Irish Bishops' Conference, and he spoke to me about the subject of suicide.
The three conferences of Scotland, England and Wales and Ireland work together on a common theme for the Day for Life each year. And last year, we decided to focus on mental health. And as a link to that, we are focusing this year on the whole area of suicide.
Is there, in some ways, perhaps a lack of clarity about the Church's position on suicide, which, of course, has long been considered a grave sin? I mean, many people just think the Church just condemns people who commit suicide, but there is actually a more compassionate approach, isn't there?
The Church's teaching with regard to suicide is very clear. What we are trying to do nowadays is to help people to understand that position in the light of present-day experience. So, for example, we believe that God gives us the gift of life, that only God can take that life back to himself. That's very clear. That's the Church's teaching with regard to the gift of life, and we celebrate that. Now, in that context, however, we're beginning to understand more fully that some people find life such an intolerable burden that they have suicidal thoughts, and some people actually go as far as committing suicide. So what the Church is trying to do is, on the one hand, keep a very clear view of our perspective on life as a gift from God, and on the other hand, then, to help all of us and families affected by suicide in particular, to help them to understand what drives somebody to take their own life, and in the context of all of that, to show forth the compassion of Christ.
And what, in fact, does drive somebody to take their own life? Can you tell us a little bit more about the reasons that prompt people to take such a drastic step?
I think it's generally accepted nowadays that people do not want to end their lives as such. What they want to do is to end the pain which has become, for many people, unbearable. And therefore, in studies in Ireland, for example, it's now shown that about 70% of cases of people who either commit suicide or attempt to do so have some form of mental illness, which obviously impairs their faculties and so on and so forth. And And within that context, the whole issue of depression is now being seen as a very important factor. And therefore, for example, in our thoughts about the Day for Life for 2009, in the leaflet that has been published by the three conferences, we are giving contact points for people who may be suffering from depression and encouraging them to avail of all the opportunities that are available to people nowadays. And in this context in particular, we're trying to take away the stigma that surrounds suicide and that surrounds the whole issue of mental health, and trying to help people to understand that if they have problems, that if they have issues, what they need to do is to look for help, and that that help is in fact readily available to them.
That stigma is still quite pronounced, isn't it? I mean, you two tend to sort of talk about it almost in whispers if somebody has committed suicide, and from the family's point of view, it's something rather shameful that they have to cope with.
Well, one of the purposes of this year's reflection on suicide is in fact to help the families to understand what might drive somebody to taking their own life. And in that way, to help them, we also want to emphasize our families the role that they can play in the prevention of suicide, and not only families, but also parish communities. So we're trying to heighten the awareness within families and within communities of the need to be watchful, to be vigilant for those who may be suffering in any way from burdens which they in fact find unbearable.
And how big a problem is suicide in Ireland? Is it mainly the young or the old who take their own lives? Does it cut across all socio-economic groups? Is it mainly men or women?
And the first thing to say is that the level of suicide in Ireland at the moment is the lowest in the last 16 years. So that's something very positive. I think that's been greatly helped by the fact that the government have set up an office for suicide prevention, and they have a campaign for mental health. And the church in Ireland is very careful to support that plan for suicide prevention. Having said that, the suicide rate among younger people is in fact the fourth highest in the European Union. That causes us grave concern. Okay? So that's one group of people in society that all of us, citizens as well as Christians, all of us are concerned about. And then within that, the ratio of men to women is in fact roughly 78% men, 22% women. So the incidence of suicide among young men is particularly alarming in this country.
Have you ever come across a case of somebody you know who has committed suicide, or perhaps a close friend of a friend? And if so, how did this news affect you?
Yes, I come from a very rural background, and I remember as a child, and I was only about 6 or 7 at the time, a neighbour and a close friend, unfortunately, took his own life on a Christmas day and left a very young family after him. And that really marked the whole community for a very long time. And it was unusual then to hear of somebody taking their own life. And of course, since then, especially in rural areas, the incidence of suicide has increased greatly in recent years. So I have personal experience of it. I know exactly how it can affect a family and how it can affect a whole community. And on the other hand, I'm very much aware of the fact that both families and communities have a great role to play in the whole area of suicide prevention. And therefore, within the whole community context, there is a growing awareness nowadays that all of us should be looking out for one another, especially in difficult times.
And what about the church? How does it specifically try to reach out to those who may be struggling with suicidal thoughts, to help them, to prevent them?
Well, one of the ways is obviously the Day for Life each year. And in fact, This is the second time in the space of, I think it's 5 years, that we have given the Day for Life theme over to the whole area of suicide and suicide prevention. So we tried to heighten an awareness within families, communities, and within the country as a whole of the need to understand suicide better, and then the need in particular to help in this whole program of suicide prevention.
Suicide, of course, is often described as a desperate plea for help. And of course, and fortunately, should I say, a lot of people who attempt to take their own lives, they don't always succeed. Would you agree with that?
It's certainly, I mean, the figures show, for example, that the an alarmingly high number of people attempt to take their own lives. And thankfully, a small enough proportion of those who attempt to do so actually do so. So it is, in fact, a very real issue facing society, the whole area of those who feel that they are under so much pressure or so much pain or so much difficulty or whatever it is that they want to attempt to take their own lives and to kind of end the pain. I think, as I said in the beginning, it's not that people want to take their own lives or end their own lives. What they really want to do to end the pain that has become for some people unbearable in life.
I was speaking to Bishop John Fleming from Ireland. Missio is the new name for the Pontifical Mission Societies in England and Wales. The societies are located in 120 countries around the world and provide care and support for the younger churches across the world, raising awareness and funds for missionary and pastoral work in every continent. The National Director of the Missio Office in England and Wales is Monsignor John Dale, and he told me more about the reasons behind the name change.
A couple of reasons, really, I suppose. One is that everyone else in Europe is doing it, and we don't like to be the odd one out on too many things. So, for example, Missio Aachen, Missio Munich have tremendous reputations throughout the missionary world, and we're kind of fitting in on the back of those. Missio Netherlands, Missio Belgium, Missio Scandinavia, and just 2 years ago, Missio Italy. And we're simply following suit. But I think, secondly, it's a way of trying to promote universal mission in a new way, in a more lively way. In the old title of Pontifical Mission Societies was just a little bit too long for people to grasp, whereas Missio is modern, it's immediate, and it does what it says on the tin. You know, it is very, very descriptive and captivating, we hope.
I was speaking to Monsignor John Dale, the National Director of Missio in England and Wales. And you can hear much more about the work and activities of Missio in a longer interview that has been aired on our programme tomorrow, Thursday. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.